Welcome to episode one of Bibliotech, the podcast about emerging technologies for academics. Is brought to you by University Affairs Magazine. My name is Rochelle Mazar, and I'm an Emerging Technologies Librarian at the University of Toronto, Mississauga. Every month, you can listen in as I talk about what's new in technology and what we as academics should be paying attention to. It's hard to keep up with all the new software, tools, and gadgets. That's where I come in. In this inaugural episode, I delve into the world of Twitter. Yes, it actually can be useful to academics. I explore how to use it to expose your ideas, learn about new research, and connect with other experts in your field. And no, these people don't just tweet about their breakfast all the time. Networks lie at the heart of all academia. Peer review, disciplinary groups, departments, research teams, even the collection in the library is evidence of academic networks. We learn from and build upon the work and knowledge in our networks. Connections to these networks is what allows us to grow. Twitter facilitates a different kind of connection, but the networks are roughly the same. One of the things most of us do is check to see what's new in our areas of interest on a regular basis. For me, that involves looking around for the latest developments on the web and reading the latest research. It can come from all kinds of quarters. In the past, I relied on a feed reader. I had painstakingly filled with potential spots on the web where good content might appear. Then at some point in the day, I would scan through all the new articles for things I should pay attention to. It can be a time-consuming process, and while I was good at keeping up with it at first, eventually the total number of unread articles in my reader was so high it hurt me to look at it. Today, my feed reader is gone, and what took its place is Twitter. But I don't need to know what someone had for breakfast. This is the most common criticism I've heard about Twitter, in spite of the fact that I rarely see people tweeting about breakfast. All new web applications, and probably all inventions generally, go through a period of collaborative cultural definition shortly after they launch. There's an immediate decision made by us as a group as to what this new thing is for, and that decision tends to stick, even when it's an inaccurate characterization. That initial metaphor doesn't always come in the PR package. Twitter, for instance, was originally designed by an employee at a company where everyone worked at odd hours and in any number of places, including the office, home, in a coffee shop, and so on. The guy who invented Twitter just wanted to know what everyone was working on at any given time, so they could all better work out who to call to interrupt, or what to work on next, or what to leave alone, or whether everyone was at the point where they needed a proper meeting. It was a means of conveying information we can traditionally gather with just a glance when we're in the same room or in adjacent offices. It's a kind of presence awareness with a bit more information attached and a history you can scroll through and search. But the question Twitter asks, "What are you doing?" taken out of that context, makes it seem like a place for all these reports about breakfast people complain about. There are entire suites of applications designed specifically as life-casting tools, which is putting all those details of daily affairs on the internet. From the start, Twitter fell into that group, even though its designers didn't really see it that way at all. There's nothing technically revolutionary about Twitter, really. It could have arisen at any time in the past, say, 15 years or so, without major differences in its functionality. Twitter and the other microblogging services like FriendFeed and Identica, and to some degree Facebook, are interesting less because of their code or their design. It's what the various groups of users have done with it that's interesting. When I find something that alters the way I think about my work, which is often, I post a link to it to Twitter, too. I share my own short versions of my revelations, commentary, criticism, lessons learned as I go along. In this way, my colleagues and I build our own professional development, one little idea at a time. I've spent a couple of years building my list of colleagues on Twitter to the point that it's now the best resource I have available to me. Some of them are in my profession, many of them are not. They do work that influences mine, or work I'd like to influence mine, and I like to see what's getting them thinking day to day. Not because I want to know what my far-flung colleagues had for breakfast, but because I want to know what they're reading, what they're recommending I read, and what they think about it. Fortunately, there's no number telling me how many tweets I've missed since I last checked. I really don't want to know. I used to rely on set publications to deliver information to me, which limited the breadth of information I could get. Now I've replaced publications with individuals who each provide their own kind of filter and perspective. Taken as a whole, their contribution to my growth is substantial. To really see Twitter at its best in an academic or professional context, go to a conference. What used to be periods of broadcast communication by a keynote or a presentation speaker, followed by shorter periods of networking interaction, questions, and the sharing of ideas, has become a seething mass of actions and reactions, all searchable and trackable through Twitter. Increasingly, conferences publish a hashtag along with the date and location of the conference, which makes it easy to find attendees on Twitter. A hashtag is a pound sign followed by a relatively distinct acronym or word. Conference goers add it to their tweets to indicate their relation to the conference. Searching Twitter for that hashtag will show you all Twitter users at the conference, and even those who aren't there but share an interest in the subject. 140 characters isn't a lot, but it's usually enough to catch not the whole of the big ideas, but pieces, elements, parts of a whole. It catches the fleeting ideas, the bits of information that come through a presentation, the stats revealed, a quick impression. At a conference, Twitter becomes a cross between whispering to your neighbor and taking notes. When the Twitterers are out in force, a keynote becomes this multifaceted experience with reactions, agreements, disagreements, commentary, questions, links to further reading, and reports on the experience, all underlying the words of the speaker. In the moment, the Twitter stream can be ignored as you pay attention to a point, and will still be there, updating at a rapid pace when you want to see how the room is reacting. It puts words to the mood of a crowd, that visceral feeling that's hard to interpret. It underscores the reality that, at conferences, we're not there simply to accept a message that's being delivered. We're participants, active thinkers, experts in our own right. We have so many media available to us right now. Books, journals, online publications, blogs, podcasts, video on demand, tweets. We have the opportunity to use the very best medium to convey the information at hand. Books are still a very good technology. If all we wanted to do was gather information about a topic, books or journal articles or other material are far better and cheaper means to do so. When we're in a room together, the value is in all of us, not just the person at the front with the microphone. Twitter is not a revolution on its own. The fact that we use it to share an in-person experience, or the small revelations of an average day, or the ongoing bibliographies of our lives, however, is. Building up a network on Twitter that reflects your professional interests takes time. There are a few ways to do it effectively and simply, though. The first way is to find a single colleague who tweets already about your area of interest. Who do they follow? Who follows them? Twitter is a wide open world of individuals, but the tweets themselves are searchable. One way to find interesting Twitter users to follow is to use the search function and see who's using certain key terms. The very easiest way to do this is to search hashtags during conference season. This is not only a great way to find interesting people to follow. Seeing tweets from a conference is a unique view into a conference you aren't attending. I often find out about conferences I probably should attend by seeing the tweets as they appear. It's not quite like being there, but it's pretty close. Another way to build up your network is through Twitter's own lists functionality. Twitter gives users tools to build lists of other Twitter users for their own reference, essentially giving users the option of categorizing each other in any way they see fit. This is extremely helpful if you're looking for, say, historians on Twitter, or librarians, or organic chemists. Someone else has probably already curated a list of people that may interest you. Cultivating a good network is a slow, organic process, but having a robust group of colleagues on Twitter gives you a very personalized and interesting perspective. It can be a fun distraction, a casual, simple way to interact with people you don't know, and sometimes a really great way to stay in tune with research that hasn't yet been published. I, for one, have next to no patience at all, and the relentless drive to make things faster, more immediate, and more constant has done nothing to instill this good quality in me. While I'm working on a project, or I have an idea, I'm often lost in the flow of it for hours at a stretch, but when I look up, I need the dialogue of feedback, even if it's just casual and short. I'm not really looking for a long crit and careful dissection. I like to get a shot of inspiration and enthusiasm from others to keep me going. I don't want to wait until someone has time to answer my email or make time to meet with me. I can do all those things later in a more measured and systematic way. But in that moment, between one idea and the next, I just want someone else with some expertise in my area to give me an off-the-cuff response. I want to test my ideas out among people who know what I'm talking about, people who have skills and experience I don't have. Here at my place of work, we call this my pathological need to share. For me, Twitter has gone a long way to helping to fill this particular void. You could call it crowdsourced feedback. A few months ago, I was working on a social media policy for a library. I mentioned this project on Twitter the morning I started working on it, and received several tips on where to find good existing policies online to model mine after. Halfway through, in a fit of both frustration and pride, I posted a draft of the document and revealed it to Twitter. It was then, reading through the responses, that I realized I had touched a nerve in my policy. We were doing something different, and that gave me a chance to think through the arguments for and against it. By the time the document was finished and presented to the library in a formal capacity, I had a lot more understanding of the issues it raised. And my documents helped a few others draft their policies as well. Because I've been able to build such a useful network, I have the opportunity to be so productively influenced by it at point of need. Not everyone has to catch my questions. It's enough that just a few people do. Twitter moves fast, and if you don't look at the screen within a few minutes of someone posting a question, you'll likely miss it. That's something I like about Twitter. No guilt, no huge pile of unread tweets waiting for me at every turn. It's like walking into a room for a few minutes, listening to the conversation as it's going on, and walking out again. No one's offended. Everyone's doing just the same thing. I follow a lot of people on Twitter. So I have a large library of knowledgeable people from a wide range of tech fields available to me. They scaffold me to reach greater heights than I could on my own. I get to stand on their shoulders when I need them, and I let them stand on mine when I can. And in the middle of all that, if someone wants to mention the frittata they're making for breakfast, I can forgive them for it. I might even ask for the recipe. That's it for this episode. If you'd like to get in touch with me about something you heard on this podcast, or would like to suggest a topic for a future episode, please post a comment at the bottom of the page where this podcast is posted at universityaffairs.ca. Until next time, I'm Rochelle Mazar.